You're listening to a podcast of Spurious Morality. Hello and welcome to a podcast of Spurious Morality. I'm Johnston and with me this week I have Gareth.
Hello.
And I have Mark.
Hello.
And we're here to do an episode I've wanted to do since we started this podcast. We're going to start looking at Blake 7. I'm really, really excited about this. I do love Blake 7 as much as Doctor Who and all the other stuff that we discuss here. And it's sort of taken a while for this to come around. It's taken a Blu-ray set coming out. And they finally announced Series 2 is getting a Blu-ray set as well. That was announced a couple of days ago, I think. Recording time anyway. This will be out about a week afterwards. But that's exciting. That's really good. So before we sort of dive in and start looking at each episode, we're doing this in the style of our Doctor Who season-by-season episode. So we're going to, by the time we've done, have looked at every single episode of Blake 7, which there's not as much as Doctor Who, so it won't take us as long. But before we dive into that, I'm just going to sort of quickly ask you guys how you found Blake 7. Was it just you'd heard that it was really good and a bit like late 70s Doctor Who like me, or is there more of a story there? You go first, Gareth.
Okay, so I was a kid in the wilderness years, so Doctor Who was like videos, and in the sleeves you would see adverts for other stuff, usually stuff I'd never heard of. So there was like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, at the time no idea what that was about, and Blake 7. And for some reason I formed what I think is an unfair preconception of the show, as it would be like Doctor Who's red-headed stepchild. And it was, I don't know why, but I kind of avoided it for a very long time because I kind of just had decided it was a bit embarrassing. Maybe it's like secondhand embarrassment from Doctor Who, I don't know, because we all know Doctor Who's a bit silly. I eventually made myself watch it, and I'll be brutally honest, it wasn't until well into my 30s that I cracked open the DVDs. So for this rewatch, for most of these episodes, it's a second viewing for these episodes. So I would say I am fond of Blake 7, still kind of curious about it, maybe a little bit more agnostic than you, but open to persuasion.
And hopefully some persuading will be done over the course of these episodes then. What about you, yeah. Mark?
Yeah, in my case, it's a not dissimilar story. Very much I had in mind that thing of Doctor Who being there first, being the first love. And then it was exactly that same thing of, you know, Blake 7 gradually creeping into the awareness via things like the back of the VHS cases. And also, and this is how old I am, pre-internet, there used to be this thing called the John Fitton mail order catalogue, which listed all the sci-fi available things, mostly Doctor Who stuff. But there were other things, and Blake 7 would have been mentioned in there. At that stage, I think some VHSs had come out, but they were like chopped down episodes in, like released in batches of three or something like that. And then I didn't really get to those for a long time, but I think the thing that sort of all made it click into place for me, where I thought I absolutely have to track this stuff down and watch it, was in the sixth form common room when I was you know, nearing the end of my secondary school at the time, obviously, a friend of mine to whom I'd been lending the Doctor Who VHSs said he'd watched one with his father the night before, and his dad had said, has Mark seen Blake 7? Like, is he aware of Blake 7? Because I think he'd really like it. And although it was sort of in there in my consciousness from just having seen these mentions of it, I'd never really thought about what it was exactly. And he relayed his father's description of it as being more or less what Gareth said, the sort of cheaper, wonkier, but actually more adult version of Doctor Who, and had mentioned certain compromising. I think he even mentioned, you know, that some of the effects had been done as cartoons, which he absolutely wasn't lying about, you know, when I saw the spaceships and things at times. But anyway, long story short, that sort of, ever the sort of champion of an underdog, you know, I think there's some part of me perversely likes to know, okay, the more rubbish something is perceived to be, the more I want to give it a chance. And then maybe I'm going to be the contrarian who loves that thing. But then I came to realize there are a lot of people who do love Blake Seven regardless. And the final thing was that I finally got seeing it via UK Gold in the late 90s. Bumped into it on a Sunday morning. And by that stage, they were showing Season D or Series 4, whatever way you want to call that. And so that, I think the first episode I saw was Animal, and I watched it right through every Sunday from there to the very end. And then I thought, I have to see the rest of this. And so the rest is history. I not long afterwards, around the early 2000s, those full box sets of VHSs started to come out. And I remember doing Season 1, I just absolutely, just going through those, like, over one Christmas, just one after another, just absolutely devouring those. So it became, it's just it's a show that sits very close to my heart. Doctor Who's right at the epicenter, but Blake Seven is definitely in its orbit, no pun intended. So,
see, I'm sort of fairly similar. Obviously, being a wee bit younger, I kind of missed the VHS era. They were very much out on DVD before I got round to watching them. But I'd always been aware of it. I couldn't possibly tell you where my awareness of Blake Seven sort of came from. I knew it was made by a lot of the same people that made Doctor Who at around the same time. I knew that it was full of Doctor Who actors, and I knew how it ended as well. It probably popped up on one of these greatest ever TV ending ever type shows. But I'd for some reason never watched it. And actually what prompted me to watch it was this was the very, very early days of YouTube. This was when it was still a fairly new thing and sort of copyright hadn't quite figured out what they were doing with it yet. And somebody had put the entire series on YouTube. So my first ever watch through of Blake Seven was actually a relatively dodgy copy. It didn't look like a DVD rip. A relatively dodgy copy on YouTube of every single episode. And over the course of a month or two, I just kind of watched it, and that was that. I was stuck into it, and I thought, right, well, I've watched it all now in really low quality and it's rather quite good. I think I should probably get the DVDs. So I did, and watched it again in considerably better quality on DVD, and was like, oh yeah, this is brilliant. This is really, really good. And I'm no stranger to ignoring dodgy special effects, with the whole lifelong Doctor Who fan thing. So it never bothered me that it does look a bit cheaper. It does look a bit more dated. There's a lot of slow paced stuff in Blake Seven as well, particularly the first series. I find there's quite a bit of padding, which is something I'm sure we'll discuss as we go on. That didn't bother me because, again, I've grown up on Pertwee six-parters, so it was kind of, it was something I was sort of really keen to get into and enjoy, and did, and still do. And it's absolutely wonderful that we're finally getting Blu-ray sets, and it's even more wonderful that the Blu-ray sets are continuing. I think there was a collective worry across all of fandom that maybe that first series was all we were going to get. Maybe it didn't sell well enough, but no, it seems to be that it's getting the complete series 1-4 treatment. So excellent. We'll dive straight in then. Let's dive straight in. We will go from the first episode, which is, of course, The Way Back. Immediately with The Way Back, Blake Seven kind of sets itself apart from, I mean, Doctor Who's always going to be the nearest comparison. Not only are we a podcast that talks about Doctor Who quite a lot, it was made at the same time as classic Doctor Who was at one of its peaks. It was made by a lot of the people that were making Doctor Who around the same time. It's BBC, it's late 70s, early 80s. The comparisons aren't going to stop. They're completely unavoidable. So let's just roll with it. But Blake Seven immediately sets itself out as darker as Doctor Who. You know, Doctor Who is never going to have a massacre in the style of the one we see in the first 15 minutes of Blake Seven. It's never going to have a character accused of molesting children. It's never going to be so downbeat. Like, Doctor Who can be grim. Doctor Who can be miserable and unpleasant and hopeless and features some incredibly dark moments, but I don't think it's ever going to go into the level of darkness and misery that The Way Back does. And I'm fine with that. It means that we automatically are dealing with something very, very different. You know, the production values and the cast and even Dudley Simpson's music gives us something that's familiar, but the tone of this is entirely out there. And I really like the way that it establishes itself. I also like that there is no hope whatsoever through this episode. The episode ends with the one glimmer of hope being killed, which is Blake's sort of solicitor and his wife get killed, and Blake is on the spaceship on his way to the prison planet, as we have been told he's going to. The bad guys win. There is no two ways about it. This first episode, the bad guys win. I just think it's such an incredibly dark but strong start, and it makes you instantly want more. It does a good job of making us care about Blake very quickly. I think it very cleverly doesn't really introduce any other main characters. You know, we have Villa and Jenna pop up for a scene or two between them, but they're not members of the Seven yet. They are just people that happen to be in a similar situation to Blake at that time. And I like the fact that this series takes its time to build up. It really is. It's four episodes before the team of heroes is assembled. It's six episodes before we meet our main villains. It really takes its time to breathe, and I think that works. This episode, The Way Back, is just about establishing Blake, re-establishing Blake as a sort of hero character, a rebel character that obviously he didn't even know he was at the start. It's such a great way, and fairly low-key, actually, way of introducing a series that goes very, very epic as it goes on. So that's enough from me. Gareth, talk to us about The Way Back.
Thank you. I would say the good news and the bad news about The Way Back is that it is arguably the strongest episode. I think there is an argument to be made that this is like the clearest distillation of the situation that's happening in this show. Not to say that there won't be better episodes, but I mean, this is a hell of a start, you know. It is, as you say, it's very bleak. I do think it does have a note of hope, which is, you know, literally the last line, which isn't very much, which is Blake saying, you know, he's coming back. It's a great example of what the Federation is like, which is, to be honest, an almost insurmountable problem. Like, if you know how the show ends, which, to be honest, most people who've heard of the show know how it ends, then watching this first episode, you are kind of like, well, yeah, because we don't have like a big bad villain. You know, we don't have a Servalan or an Emperor Palpatine or anything. What we've got is we've got bureaucracy and we've got people who are just following this stuff. And we do find out that Blake and a lot of the citizens are essentially being drugged to some extent to be more passive. They're being mollified. Which I think is something that maybe they don't explore as much as they could do, but it's clear that's why Blake is, you know, so happy with the so okay with the status quo. You know, there's a bit in it where he says, you realize going outside is a category 4 crime. And you're like, that's a hell of a thing to say, just to be like, that's normal. But there are so many characters in this that are villainous in the literal sense, not in the, you know, moustache twirling evil sense. And they're just at work. Like, I don't get the impression they're being mollified. There's, I can't remember the actor's name, but the guy who plays Lesterson in The Power of the Daleks is in this, and he's on like a sort of tribunal of people who are aware of Blake, and they want to have him, you know, shipped off. And there's this woman on the. I'll use the word tribunal. I'm sorry, it's probably not accurate, but there's the woman on this group. And she's quite casually saying, you know, oh yeah, let's get him, you know, framed or whatever. Let's just, you know, get rid of the guy. And you just think, this is so casual and ingrained that you just think, Doctor Who couldn't fix this. Like, if Tom Baker turned up, he couldn't go, oh, here's the problem. You know, you've got a big slug and it's actually controlling all of the, you know, computers, and they're feeding out false information. You know, there's stuff like the guy who, I think Nigel Lambert is the actor. I mostly know him as the voice on Look Around You. He's the bloke who they forced to look up some information, and he's got those groovy kind of virtual reality disco goggles on, which is a bit everybody loves. He more than happily shops Blake to the authorities the second he's gone. And you're like, there's no gun to his head. There's no indication that these people are under the influence. So it's just, it's so bleak. You know, it's not just about the fact that there's a massacre in it, and which is, of course, you know, incredibly hard-hitting, especially if you accidentally tune in thinking this is Doctor Who. But it's just this atmosphere of just like, that's what it's like. That's the world he's in. And it's just, my God, I mean, I genuinely don't know at this point in the series what he could possibly hope to achieve. He'd need so much reform. Yeah, so it's incredibly bleak in that sense. And it's great, and the next couple of episodes are good at this as well. Like, it's very rare that you come across this in a long-running TV series, that it keeps you guessing about who the characters are even going to be, because it keeps killing them. So, you know, you've got this guy who is willing to believe that Blake has been framed for these awful crimes, and he's killed, and not just killed, screen. So we don't even see that. We just, you know, matter-of-factly show his and his wife who didn't do anything, dead. And you think, as well as that, and I'll try to stop going on in a sec, the characters in this, who I kind of describe as, like, you know, normal villainous, we don't see them again. I'm pretty sure that's the case for at least most of them. You know, these are not presented as your villains who we're going to revisit. These are just, well, that's the staff who were on that Tuesday. So, yeah, just the stakes of this are so high, and just impossibly high, really, that it's a real mission statement to kind of go, yeah, beat this, you know, Blake, what are you going to do about that? Yeah, and I will just very quickly mention, this will probably be worth mentioning on all the episodes, I've watched the updated special effects on the Blu-ray. They look great. They're not ostentatious. They are very in keeping with the show, but they've also done model shots. So they've kind of bridged the gap. Like, the model shots in the original show looked good, but whenever you'd cut to, like, as Mark says, the kind of cartoon spaceships, that wouldn't look great. You know, it would kind of break disbelief a little bit. I'm sure it's fine for the time, but there is that disconnect here. They've really bridged the gap a lot. The models look great. I think the CGI is not showy. It's, you know, it's very in keeping. You might, you know, almost be fooled when you're watching it and just kind of go, oh, it looked good for the time, didn't it? But yeah, incredible. Very strong opening. And yeah, just the nerve of it to not set everything up, you know, to just go, here's the general situation. I'm very impressed by that.
I think you've got a point about it being like one of the best episodes of Blake 7. It really, really is. But it's also not really an episode of Blake 7. You know, the first 2-3 episodes kind of serve as a prologue. Like I say, they assemble the Seven, but this isn't the status quo. It establishes what the Federation is, but it doesn't establish the Liberator and, you know, teleportation and what Blake's actual mission is and all this kind of thing. It really holds that back and lets us just, we meet Blake, we meet the world that Blake lives in. And you're right, it isn't a failing society, it's a failed society. It's whoever is going to take over has taken over. And people are either drugged so they don't care or completely on board with this totalitarianism. So it's such a dark start, and it's not even a taste of this is what the series is going to be, this is what's in store for you. It's kind of something else, and I think it's such a memorable episode because it is just so unlike any other Blake 7. There's a couple of big finish sets, the Avalon sets, that kind of pick up on what's going on around these episodes and this sort of world, and it ties off a few loose ends that are left in this episode, because, as you say, we don't see a lot of these characters again. And I quite like the fact that they do that. It's Big Finish playing with continuity and tying up loose ends in a good way. So yeah, I'm all for it. And I've said it before on this podcast, I hope we get more of that Avalon run from Big Finish. It's been a few years since it came out now, but it was sort of quite interesting to follow the events of these first few episodes in parallel, from the perspective of different characters. Mark, The Way Back.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, you've both covered a lot of ground there. I'm just going to throw in at this point that picking up on what you both said about the very sort of this isn't an episode of Blake Seven as we will come to know it. There used to be a tradition back in the day. Well, not a tradition so much as just something that used to happen, which was they used to make, you know, these things called plays for today or whatever for the BBC. And they would be one-offs, but then every now and again, something would catch the eye of a BBC exec somewhere. They'd go, oh, can we make more of that? Like Steptoe and Son was an example. That was just a one-off play for today thing. The Boys from the Black Stuff was spawned from a one-off thing. And then
Gangsters was as well, wasn't it?
Which one?
Gangsters.
Oh, Gangsters, yeah, I'd forgotten about that one. And then, of course, on the sci-fi front, there was a thing called The Flip Side of Dominic Hyde, which ended up getting a sort of a follow-up under the same sort of play for today type banner, but nevertheless a continuation. And if you were watching this thing without really knowing anything about it, you could absolutely be forgiven for thinking that's what had happened here. You know, it feels so self-contained and so like this cast belongs only to this episode, apart from the people who we know will later go on to be regulars, that it feels like something making a particular bit of commentary about, you know, how society could go if we're not careful, and, you know, Big Brother is watching, and all those sort of, you know, tropes and things. It's really, really well done. It's, because I came to Blake Seven having been sort of weaned on the back end of it, you know, the sort of very Avon-centric or very Avon-led, you know, Series D, I had to kind of adjust you know, quite significantly to how Season 1 felt. Now, I did end up really liking it. But it's Series 4 is always kind of the baseline for me in terms of like what how I like my Blake Seven. But this thing, you know, yeah, absolutely kicked it off amazingly well. And I mean, as you say, like, I mean, that promise of it being, you know, what Doctor Who could do if it was allowed to go darker and show these more complex totalitarian societies, and it's not a slug monster or something controlling things, like Gareth was saying. And the fact that you've got a hero, you know, who is fitted up on these false charges of, you know, like a really sickening thing that's never really referred to in the rest of the series. Somehow just that particular charge never seems to be associated with Blake out there in the universe, and people, he does seem to just end up being this Robin Hood type figure to most. Thank God, because you wouldn't want, you know, regular references to him having to defend himself against that charge that everybody and his dog seems to know about, you know, and going, oh, did you really do that? And then belonging to this first episode, it feels absolutely appropriate to the conditions. And then his sort of court appointed lawyer guy there, the fact that he even goes and investigates at all feels very anomalous for the society. He's an unusual man, you know. He's somebody with a bit of moral backbone, in a sea of otherwise just tranquilized people, happy to go about inside the dome and do whatever to make an easy life for themselves. And so it's the system that Blake's fighting. The very end, this has just one of the best closing lines to any introductory episode to anything ever. This is the one bit where I suppose, you know, is the tell that it's not a one-off play for today. It's when he says, no, I'm coming back. And I love the way Gareth Thomas kind of underplays that line. By underplaying it, he gives it so much more emphasis somehow. It's just thrown in there and then bang, into the credits. And just one final thing, because I know we need to crack along here, but the opening title sequence is pretty effective insofar as it does some of the storytelling for you, or at least it will do that in the weeks to come. I guess you're given, you know, you're given in the title sequence a little synopsis of what's going on. You see totalitarian regime who needs to be literally eliminated, and then you get a sense of that there will be this mission across the stars and the iconic ship and all the rest of it. Sorry, I tell a lie. They don't show the Liberator at all, do they? And that it's just security cameras and you know, scary looking guards and Blake screaming in pain and stuff like that. Do we get to see this? I can't even remember at this point whether we get to see the Liberator in the title sequence of season one. Anyway, that's straying off the point. Just there was a bit of an art in those days to sort of saying, here's the series in a nutshell in your title sequence. And okay, now on with the... but you're right, we won't really see... I think what happens is you get those first three episodes, which are all doing a particular thing each. And then episode four is a sort of an awkward bridge into regular programming, and then from about episode five onwards, I think we'll see what Blake Seven more typically is or evolves to become. Yeah, so that's my thoughts on episode one.
It's quite interesting how it is a sort of, it feels fast paced because every episode is doing something different at this stage, and the way back an awful lot happens. It doesn't lull. We don't have endless scenes of them steering the Liberator to a certain angle to dock with another ship or something like that. It just keeps moving, it keeps going, and I love the way it does sort of cut off with the lawyer just being killed, and sort of it, the good guys don't win, and we have that defiant I'm coming back. And then we move on to episode two, Spacefall, and it we don't really see any sign of him coming back. There's a bit of a mutiny on the ship, which all goes wrong, and then they find the Liberator, and they go, right, well, we're going to follow the ship and rescue our friends that are on there. I think Spacefall gives you a really good sense of being an episode that takes place over months. Like, you do see the time passing, you see certain tensions building and all that kind of thing. It actually handles a time jump quite effectively for, well, time jumps just don't generally tend to happen, do they, in 70s British TV. It's all very here and now. There certainly aren't really any Doctor Who's that are set over a long period of time. I think Marco Polo is probably the one exception. But this is sort of really, really interesting because it's claustrophobic, but it has far more in the way of characters. It introduces a new set of villains. And they're not really villains. They're just the ship's crew. One of them, Raker's a particularly nasty piece of work, but he's just part of the Federation. Again, he's just doing his job. He just happens to be the person that's on that ship that's responsible for making sure the prisoners all behave themselves. We get introduced to Avon. That's the big thing about this episode. We meet Gan as well, who kind of just... He is what Jenna and Villa were in the first episode. He's just there. He's just another character in this. Whereas Avon immediately becomes a significant character from the moment the episode starts. We kind of go, here's a new guy. He's going to make things a little bit different. And obviously at the time, I don't think even the people making it realised how significant a character Avon would become. He's just another prisoner on the ship at this point. He's given a bit of an interesting backstory, but it's so's Gan, so's Villa, so's Jenna. It's all fairly par for the course. There are some great performances in this episode. I think is it Leslie Schofield, I think, as Raker, who is the nasty piece of work I mentioned before. Absolutely brilliant, like genuinely gets the whole nasty Federation sadist getting on with his job nice and efficiently thing. He gets it across so perfectly well. One of the great villains that we see in Blake Seven. I think the fact that he's not discussed more often is purely down to the fact that he appears in this and that's it. You know, he's dead by the end of the episode. It's really, really good to sort of see the grimness carrying on. You know, we have characters that we kind of think, oh, you know, maybe they're going to be major characters moving on, and they end up getting killed in some pretty gruesome ways in some cases. Like, there's one character who gets trapped in the workings of the spaceship and essentially crushed, suffocated, take your pick to death by quick-setting emergency hull sealing foam. That's a pretty grim way to go. So yeah, it's the pretty dark tone has carried on. I think I said you'd never get the way back in Doctor Who. I think Spacefall probably is something you get in Doctor Who, actually. There are bits in there that are kind of reminiscent of the Daleks executing slaves in Destiny of the Daleks. You've got Raker executing prisoners on the ship and that kind of thing. So I think maybe we are more into tonally similar territory to Doctor Who here. We've had some pretty nasty spaceship commanders, base commanders or whatever, but I still think it has that unique Blake Seven sort of twist to it. So Gareth, go ahead.
Well, I think it's interesting that it's the next, well, not the next day, but as you say, it follows a lot of time, but it's serialized after the way back. So it's very much the way back part two. So if you were tuning in at the time, you might honestly have thought this series was going to be 13 episodes of like the next week, the next week, the next week for these characters. It does carry over that tone of general kind of hopelessness. And I think a sort of emblem of that is the fact that the villains, again, in this episode, are even more just people at work. These are not even people who have a great deal to do with the Federation. So you've got the guy who's running the ship, genuinely a nice bloke. Like, he's such a nice bloke that he's obviously pained by the fact that he's got this lunatic on his staff who goes beyond the pale. And eventually, you know, he hands himself in his report and says, yeah, I'm gonna dob you in, but I'm totally going to accept responsibility for it as well. We never find out exactly how that's going to go for this guy, but, you know, we're presented with a character who's basically quite nice. We've got a younger sort of underling character who's learning the ropes. He's studying for an exam. You get the impression he's full of potential. He's not necessarily a dodgy bloke, but he might go along with some things. But again, he doesn't feel like he's been controlled by the Federation to do this, that, and the other. So, you know, it's characters like that kind of muddy the equation in an interesting way, because you think, well, what are we going to do about this person if he's convinced by his job that he needs to stop Blake? Then you've got Raker, who, it's interesting how everyone can remember that character's name. Like, the other characters I can't remember, but him, you know. And he's essentially a psychopath. I mean, he's just a violent individual who obviously enjoys the leeway that the Federation gives him. Like, he's aware of the rules and he's able to abuse them. And yeah, he's a dreadful presence. Again, though, I kind of feel like this is just an awful guy. Like, if he wasn't in the Federation, and we'll meet people in the next episode who aren't and are quite capable of being, you know, evil, per se. Raker is just a rotten apple. It's kind of bombarding Blake with these examples of, well, here are problems where, again, you can't kill an Emperor Palpatine and sort this out. This person is like this. So I think it's really interesting, like, human drama stuff to go, there are just complicated people out there. Some of them are all right. Some of them could go either way. Some of them are dreadful. So yeah, it's we're still not really sure what exactly he's going to fight against. And in the course of the story, as you mentioned, the mutiny happens and it doesn't go very well. So Raker is able to manipulate the situation and particularly Blake's, you know, sensibilities to go, right, well, I'll just start killing hostages then. And I think that's a good point, that it is a little bit like Doctor Who. Frankly, the Doctor does tend to wind up in prison a couple of times over the course of the show. So this is something you could imagine more or less happening. Jenna, who I think, you know, is briefly introduced in the first episode, and in this one, she, I think that's true. Sorry if that's incorrect. She has some more stuff to do here because Raker is kind of trying to have his way with her. And I think, horrible as it is, it's some of the best material that she gets in the show, because she gets to really stand on her own 2 feet and tell this guy to do one. And yeah, we gradually meet the rest of the crew, well, some of the rest of the crew, and it's still very embryonic. Like you mentioned, the guy who dies in the walls is firstly horrifying. Secondly, I don't think they really mention him again after that. So you get the impression that if, you know, for example, Gan, if he fell down a manhole or something, or, you know, Villa accidentally tripped out of an airlock, no one's going to cry about it, you know, because they don't know who these people are and it's that kind of universe. So it's doing a really good job still of applying that kind of basic, the world isn't very nice actually, logic to even the characters we're introducing. So through the course of it, we meet Gan, and he basically, you know, presents himself as a surprisingly, given later developments, violent character. Jenna kind of comes into her own a bit, so you go, right, this is definitely someone we want on the team. Villa, who, it's quite funny really, in the first episode I think he presents himself as a bit more of a tough guy, and that facade very quickly drops, I think partly because Avon is around, and like you get the sense he wouldn't buy that. But Villa has this marvelous quality where, whether it was because of the actor or not, I don't know, but he either gets the funniest lines or he gets to feed the funniest lines. Like there's one in the first episode, he goes to Blake, friends in high places, can't you put a word in for me? And Blake goes, I'll try and think of one, which just that's like the level of Villa. But then you've got Avon, and he is the standout. And this is a character who is this incredibly quiet, unobtrusive kind of, I don't want to say nerd because that sounds derogatory, but like he's a computer guy, and he's really, he knows he's better at this stuff than anyone else. And that certainly includes Blake. So he's already got a plan. By the time they meet him, he has already considered selling everybody out. That is our first impression of the man, right? He's quite capable of going, this could work to my advantage, we could just jettison all of you. He doesn't do it, because as they point out, well, they'd have no reason to keep you around. So it's just a very interesting way to slowly introduce these characters in a very unobtrusive way, in a kind of, well, maybe they'll stick around, maybe we'll kill them next week. That's a great kind of tension. The only thing about the episode that really feels a little bit clunky is the introduction of the Liberator, which I feel like is very much a bit of business that they just kind of need to tick off. They're like, right, we know they need a spaceship, they need a TARDIS equivalent, if you will. So that the prison ship just comes across this incredible spaceship. And they do manage to mine some drama out of this. And, you know, Blake, having completely failed with the mutiny, like really belly flopped, you know, and that's important, by the way, in the series, because you're going, he's not good at this. Like, he could be. He has been before. He doesn't really remember that. But he's not there yet. In acquiring the Liberator, they are able to kind of, you know, flick up a V sign at the bad guys on the prison ship, and, you know, by definition, the Federation as well. And they get aboard the Liberator. And even then, we're still not done, because they want to go to Cygnus Alpha, rescue who they can out of the crew, which is a lot more proactive than, you know, the first episode, I'm coming back. You know, it's more of a statement. But again, it's that similar kind of ending where it's like, we're not done, we've got work to do. And the Liberator is very interesting, but at the same time, I do have a slightly hard time kind of ignoring the fact that they just luck into it. But at the same time, that's kind of where they are as rebels. They're not good at stuff. They kind of need a hand. So, you know, the only reason Blake and co survive this whole prison ship thing, with Raker on the rampage and all of that, is that they do have this external force. So you could kind of forgive it as being like, well, at this stage of the rebellion, they need a deus ex machina, basically. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. So yeah, I always think of Spaceball quite fondly as being like more of the same in the best way of the way back. But yeah, it does an awful lot of heavy lifting and like busy work to get the show a bit more into shape. But I think with the whole Raker thing, it manages to feel like it's actually doing something with the characters.
Yeah, I agree with you that the kind of the episode sort of ends 10-15 minutes early, and oh, by the way, here's a spaceship, guys. It doesn't sort of naturally blend into everything else that's going on, and the sort of life on the prison ship and the mutiny is far more interesting than them finding this ship. But you know, we had to get them off the prison ship and onto the Liberator somehow, and I'm not unhappy with the way that it goes. I think there is some interesting sort of structural story type stuff going on in this season. I think the fact that it's all one writer trying to push out the whole thing, you know, it's all Terry Nation in series one, kind of contributes towards that. Mark, go ahead, talk to us about Spacefall.
Yeah, so that thing you mentioned at the outset, Johnson, about the episode playing out over several months, it didn't occur to me for ages until a bit of a niche reference, but I know one you'll both get because you both, I think definitely you, Johnson, and I think Gareth as well, have heard the Caldor City stuff, and there's a sort of a little coda episode of the Caldor City range which sort of kind of overlaps a bit with the Blake Seven universe, and in that somebody who may or may not be Avon but like goes by another nom de plume because copyright says he appears to be relating the events of Blake Seven to another character, and he mentions something that didn't occur to me, and that, which is a sort of an odd continuity thing. The Liberator appears to go directly to Cygnus Alpha in episode 3, but the London has nevertheless been traveling for these several months. And I think in that audio spin-off, this Caldor City thing, they take the opportunity to say, oh, we passed through a spatial anomaly or a wormhole or something to try and sort of retrospectively smooth that one over, because it does appear, you know, that the Liberator goes directly from point A to point B while in the meantime somehow several months are elapsing for the London. But putting that to one side and using that wee bit of headcanon that thankfully was offered to us there, it's one of these things. I suppose one thing we haven't mentioned at thus far in is that Terry Nation notionally wrote every episode of the first series. I think in some cases, it certainly going by the recent Blu-ray extras and so on, there are suggestions that what he actually handed in was a page and a half of a synopsis, and Chris Boucher maybe did have more of a hand even early on than has previously been known to be the case in terms of fleshing it all out. But nevertheless, it is a very Terry Nation-y second episode, because it is that you know you rightly say, Johnson, like it kind of almost retreats into that Doctor Who-ish realm of, oh, okay, Villa, you go over there and distract the guard with a magic trick while we do this, and you know somebody does this and somebody does that, and yes, it absolutely feels more aligned to the Doctor Who universe, but bar one or two things that stray into the more adult area, like what Raker's intentions clearly are towards Jenna. The other character at Grafty, or Gareth, sorry, I have the same thing where, you know, comparatively I see the captain as a nice guy, but it's interesting that in this universe, you know, our standard of a nice guy is basically somebody who will still turn around to Raker and say, like, I think I know what you're going to get up to here, but can you just for God's sake be discreet to give me an easy life? You know, he's not virtuous, he's just worn down and not as bad as the other guy. But yeah, so what else? Oh yeah, the Avon arriving is the absolute godsend of this episode, because I think it is, you know, for me it's kind of the probably one of the two least interesting episodes of the first season for me, just because it feels a wee bit like more of the same, and it feels like we're treading water to get to the Liberator and getting things going in terms of the regular format. Avon is just brilliant from the word go, and these characters really do arrive like fully, they feel very fully formed from the outset. I know Paul Darrow will go to much greater excesses later on in terms of how he plays Avon, and personally I love that, you know, by the time, you know, because I was, as I say, like I started with series four, so I nearly was almost mildly disappointed the first time I saw him come in season one, because I was doing a comparison and was like, oh, he comes in with a wee bit less, you know, over the topness, which, you know, feels appropriate for series one. But anyway, it took a little while to get used to. I'm one of these 1 in 100 Blake Seven fans who prefers Scorpio and Slave to the Liberator and Zen. So that bit at the end where they do finally make it aboard and it's like, get used to it. I kind of was like, okay, you know, it's not as interesting to me as the other setup, but I gradually warmed to the Liberator and Zen over time. But I always have that residual feeling when I'm watching Spacefall that, yeah, it's just like, there's just part of me just wants to be like, oh, get on with it, you know. Let's wrap this stuff up and just get to the week to week adventuring stuff. Yes, I think that's probably enough from me on that one, and we'll rattle on.
Yeah, it's, I guess it is kind of more of the same, but I kind of like how this zeroes down on one nasty character. This zeroes down on Reiko, where it was the first episode we've got a nasty establishment and a lot of people working within that. I think that zeroing in and sort of showing the kind of person the Federation breeds and enables in Reiko is quite effective. And it's Blake works well with a nemesis. Like, I know we get Travis in a few episodes' time, but at this point, Raker's just a nice little one-off nemesis for Blake to play against, and I think that works pretty well. Third episode, then, is Cygnus Alpha. We're carrying on with the sort of serialized nature. This is kind of the last one in what I guess is an opening three-parter. We've arrived at the prison planet. We have the Liberator and the first mission of the Liberator's crew, which is Blake, Jenna and Avon at this point, is to recruit some more people, rescue their fellow prisoners. Meanwhile, on Cygnus Alpha, there's some weird sci-fi religion stuff going on. Brian Blessed is being Brian Blessed. Pamela Salem fancies Gan for some reason, and that's, it just sort of falls into less than great episode of Doctor Who territory, I have to admit. This I think is Blake Seven's first dud. I think we have this wonderful build up in the first two episodes, and it kind of, you know, we've been introduced to this Federation, the, you know, the people that it creates, the culture of it, the nature of it, and now we're just kind of mucking about on a quarry at night somewhere with Brian Blessed being a high priest and doing a bit of shouting. It's just not quite as good as the first two, is what I'm trying to say. It does what it needs to do, though. You know, it establishes what the Liberator can do. You know, we've got the weaponry sort of isomorphic. We've got that it has a teleport system that the crew's able to kind of figure out. And we've got the sort of beginning of the occasional debate that is, should Avon just take the ship and escape? And, you know, we have this across a few episodes, particularly over the first two seasons. Avon sort of going, oh, should I do a bunk? And a computer says to him, no, it's impossible that you'll survive for particularly long. And he goes, all right, I won't then. So that's a running theme. But it sort of kind of gets stuck in a loop, like Avon, will he betray everybody? It kind of always falls down to the same thing. Oh, should I run off? Oh, no, I won't. I'll never survive on my own. And it's kind of not really doing the character that we met in Spacefall justice. I've not an awful lot to say about Cygnus Alpha. It does its job. It gives us two more members of the crew. It gives us Villa, and, you know, who finally actually gets onto the Liberator, and it gives us Gan, kills off a couple of other characters, and bizarrely, some of them choose to stay on the prison planet despite mutinying against it the previous week. Whatever, go ahead. It's all right. It's just, it feels a little bit disconnected from the first two, even though it is essentially part three of the prologue to Blake 7. I guess it kind of hints at what we're going to get moving forward. There is a lot of sort of hanging around the Liberator for the first half of the episode before things actually get going, which we will see in the next episode. We will see in the web. We will see in... there's a bit of it in Duel as well. So yeah, there is an awful lot of, oh, this is happening on the Liberator. Let's deal with this before we go and enter the main plot of the actual show. But that's, you know, we're dealing with 50-minute episodes here. If this was Doctor Who, all we'd go is, oh, they don't come out the TARDIS for most of the first part. But because it's sort of self-contained episodes, it feels a bit strange. Nevertheless, like I say, enjoyable episode, can't really argue with it, does what it needs to do, and by the end of it, I feel like I know where the series is actually going to go now, and I think that's the important point, is by the end of this third episode, we are aware, okay, this is what Blake 7 is going to be then, this is the purpose of the series. Gareth, you go ahead, talk to us about Cygnus Alpha.
Sure. Before I do, I just want to say with the mention earlier on of the behind the scenes stuff on Blake 7, the Blu-ray, if anybody's interested, I would really recommend the production diary books that are available. I think Jonathan Helm wrote those. They go into a lot of detail about sort of how the show is made, and also the thing you said, Mark, about how Chris Boucher was doing a lot of heavy lifting. I think that is very true. That was the impression I got from the book. He was a very unsung hero kind of stuff. With Cygnus Alpha, I think it's true that it's a bit of a stumble. It's not, you know, not even the worst in this first clutch of episodes. Obviously, we'll get to those in another session. But it doesn't feel as much like it's set in the same world, literally, because we're no longer talking about people at work or people in a government that's corrupt. We're looking at a situation that is, again, leaning a bit even more Doctor Who. Like, okay, we've landed on a planet that's got a bit of a dodgy situation going on, cultists worshipping this, that, and the other. We've got a bad guy, and, like, what a bad guy, you know. Brian Blessed, you're getting your money's worth there. So it's sort of immediately not quite as true to the sort of ethos of the show that we've had so far. I think it's still doing some useful work for the series, at least. Like you're saying about how the show kind of parcels out its premise for the first few episodes. We're still doing that here. So you've still got the crew learning, you know, how to use the Liberator. If you're like me and you've got any sort of problem with the sheer convenience of the Liberator, this is kind of cover your ears stuff, because it's like, not only have we found this amazing spaceship, but it's got a wardrobe with clothes that fit. And it's got laser guns that will, you know, attach to anybody. And we've got these teleport bracelets that are going to be a bit of a point of contention going forward, I think, because Cygnus Alpha is the first example of, let's take a bunch of teleport bracelets somewhere, we'll lose a bunch of them, and then by the time we come to next week, no one's going to be particularly worried that we've diminished the supply. To be honest, the Liberator is magic enough that I suppose it could be just regenerating them, so to speak. But that's always kind of annoys me. There's a bit in this specifically where Brian Blessed is kind of trying to put the thumb screws on Blake by literally just crushing these teleport bracelets to kind of go, yeah, you know, you're not the big powerful man. I think it's somewhat interesting because it's an example of Blake, again, trying to sort of do a rebellion. And again, he's really not that great at it at this point. You know, Brian Blessed is kind of easily able to turn the tables on him. He's got a power play going on where he tells the he poisons the people with food and drink, convinces them that they've got a disease that only his medicine will fix, and then just keeps them ill so they don't leave. That's definitely a weak point of the story, I think, because I think I'm right in saying, you know, Blake just goes along to see the rest of the gang now they're in a big cell. And you see Gan kind of acting a bit silly, to be honest, sort of going, oh, I'm really ill now. Oh, I guess we can't leave. And you kind of think, I've not seen any evidence that anyone's ill. Like, I don't know if they could stretch the budget that far, but it really felt a bit kind of tell, don't show there. And that's not the only aspect to it. You mentioned Pamela Salem who obviously wonderful actress, and she's in this as one of the kind of, I suppose, cult, for want of a better word, characters on this planet. And she obviously takes an instant shine to Gan, and that kind of carries through the episode right until the end. And then she just gets killed off, and you kind of go, what was that about? Like, and it's not as if, you know, we're all grown ups. You don't really need an explanation for why one character is interested in another character. But in scripted television, you know, that's something you should do something with. It's not like she, you know, rescues Gan at the last minute. It's just kind of sits there and doesn't really do anything. The situation of this planet is tenuously related to the Federation. It's the Federation's fault this has happened. You know, this is like a prison colony gone out of hand over generations. So there is an argument to be made that this is still Federation storytelling, but yeah, it just feels like a random colony planet. What I do like is that, again, we're in a situation where, you know, Blake and co. could be picking up crew members. They essentially don't, because, you know, almost all of them either die or, as you say, just decide to stick around. One of them is a character actor called David Ryle, who I was just really surprised to see in this small role. He's a very interesting actor. He's usually in period dramas and things. But, yeah, so there's really nothing much of value going on the planet. But you've got to admire the kind of cleverness, the sort of meta accidental cleverness of Avon to be like, I'm not wasting my time with that. So he just stays on the ship and, you know, does what he does. And there's a good scene where, well, I think it's a good scene where he says to Jenna, look, we can just take these jewels and go, screw this. And I think, although that is something that will be overdone, I think at this stage of the show, it's important. And I think it's interesting to kind of battle for Avon's soul, to kind of go, is he someone who even gives a damn about this so-called mission they're all on? Because he didn't sign up for this. He, you know, he didn't want to go to Cygnus Alpha, but he's not rebelling. That's not why he was arrested. So I think, you know, that moment, and it certainly won't be the last, was an interesting kind of indicator of where he's at. So like episode 2, he's already going to sell them all out, and then he decides, oh, all right, it won't work. This week, tentatively, he's going along with it, but, you know, he decides, okay, fine, Jenna's not that up for it, so I guess we won't. So that's kind of interesting, but yeah, I agree, there's not really a lot else happening. You do get a Brian Blessed performance, and I think Brian Blessed is a very underrated actor. You know, he can do subtle, he can do careful, he's always known for this shouting stuff, that's not all he is, but this is a shouty one. So it's, that's not a bad thing, but, you know, it's a little bit, this is not as interesting to me. It's like bureaucrats in a dreadful system. So, yeah, it's not an episode I feel strongly about in any direction, to be honest. I kind of like that there is a part 3 to this story. And, you know, I like that there's this triptych story at the beginning of Blake 7. But, yeah, this is the first time in the series where you go, ooh, actually, maybe it won't always be, you know, an interesting drama that you couldn't do in Doctor Who. Bit wonky, but anyway, that's where I am with it.
I think it's, I mean, increasingly, you know, we've moved into serialized television territory. All of the biggest series are now ongoing serials. There isn't like a weekly incident, monster of the week type thing. Doctor Who kind of bucks that trend. And, you know, even then, Doctor Who has recently lent more into serialized storytelling. You know, we've, even though the 60th anniversary specials were three separate stories, they all led into each other. It was kind of, it felt serialized. Flux, obviously, was one big six-parter and all this kind of thing. And I think it's very easy to forget that Blake 7 was never meant to be serialized. It just happens to be that the first few episodes are, but the nature of the way TV was made back then, you needed your monster of the week type thing, which we're going to see a bit of moving forward. And this is kind of a bit of a carrying on the serial, but also monster of the week type hybrid, which there's got to be room for. And again, you know, series 2 of Blake 7, which I know we're quite a way off yet, there's a very strong arc running through that series, but we still have incident, monster, whatever of the week, pretty much all the way through. There are very, very few episodes that are almost completely dedicated to the ongoing storyline. So, Mark, talk to us about Cygnus Alpha.
Okay, well, you described Cygnus Alpha there a short time ago, Johnson, as being a bit of a dud, and I tend to disagree with that. But it's interesting that you, because I've been having my own, I think this has happened to me a few times, because my rewatches of Blake 7 are more spaced out than my rewatches of Doctor Who, which is more or less just an ongoing life project, you know. And so when I do come back to them, I have this notion in my head that there are dud ones, and I sort of tend to misremember where the duds are. And I had a feeling that I think for me, episode two and episode four, which I know we'll get to shortly, those two feel like the weakest to me. Episode three, I can see why it looks a bit sort of throwaway and irrelevant and so on, but despite completing this sort of trilogy thing. But I think it does a couple of interesting things. First of all, it in a series that's going to continue for as long as it intended to, it needs to set up a sense that you can have, it's already set up a sense that you have the Federation, right? And you have these Federation worlds. But then this is maybe the first instance of what you might call like Federation adjacent worlds. Like they're slightly to the left of the Federation. You know, they're on a very long leash, as it were. You know, and there's stuff going on there that's just a little ecosystem of that own planet that, you know, that wee society has kind of crept in, where Brian Blessed is able to take control and have his acolytes and all the rest of it. And it's also doing an ongoing thing, I guess, that episode two also touched on, which was there's this ongoing guessing game of like, well, the program's called Blake 7. Who are the seven? Who can you spot in this week's episode that we think might be potentially joining the crew? Last week it was the guy that ended up stuck in the wall, so we could rule him out. This week, you know, maybe it's that guy that does seem to sort of forge a bit of he has a bit of a fractious but ultimately friendly attachment to Gan and Villa there, and that guy could become one of the seven. No, he stays behind. So there's an ongoing game alongside this business of showing you the different formats and paths that the series could take, and obviously in future we'll also have missions. You know, we haven't yet got to the first instance of like, okay, Blake has decided on this week's mission. We're just purely getting to the let's assemble the team, let's survive this. I can forgive. I might be different from maybe the average Blake 7 fan insofar as I can forgive a lot of things. I could forgive certain plot thinness if atmosphere is done really well. And I think on Cygnus Alpha, atmosphere is done really well. It feels like a fever dream of a place, you know? And to me, it's not that surprising that Gan genuinely feels he's ill, because the place would make you feel that way anyway, just by dint of being there. And so I can see how in that heady atmosphere, somebody with the charisma of Brian Blessed's character does absolutely win people over and sell them this idea that they need this kind of dependency on these drugs and so on. This episode, to just mention something a wee bit funnier, has probably maybe the worst special effect in the entire series, where Brian gets teleported into space and there's just this awful shot that just completely rubbish, where he explodes. And I think he's shouting in space at the same time. But I agree that he is a much more nuanced actor than his reputation would have you believe. He doesn't help himself there, of course, by doing many adverts where he just purely screams into the microphone. But of course, that's a good paycheck for him. I've had that experience throughout my rewatch of season one of thinking, oh, that thing that I thought was a dud is much less of a dud than I thought it was, and I was really, really mesmerized by that for the full 15 minutes. So, and yes, that business, I think the highlight of the episode is Avon deciding whether he's going to cut and run and calculating the odds. They set him up like, it's something that later gets echoed in the Big Finish audios, where he considers himself a machine, you know, and he's at home with machines because he likes to calculate the odds and play and take emotion out of the equation. But he's not really, you know, by the end of the series, he's not really fooling anyone on that one. He'll have us believe by the end that he is, you know, he will even nod towards being a psychopath and so on, but he's absolutely not that, you know. He just likes, you know, it suits him to have that believed of him. So yeah, I think there's some really interesting stuff going on even in this third episode. It's not a perfect thing by any means, but it's certainly got this very heady atmosphere. It fills 50 minutes very nicely, and it's the next one that I think is the real trudge to get through, but I guess we'll touch on that in time.
Yeah, maybe I was being a bit harsh calling this one a dud. It's definitely the weakest of the three so far for me, and it feels like we've lost a bit of the pace and energy that we had in the first two. But it's, as I said before, it does its job, and there is some interesting stuff going on. It just feels a little bit jarring to be, I guess, disconnected from the Federation and, you know, looking at, as you say yourself, kind of the outer worlds of it. But again, you know, that's the direction we have been told the spaceship has been moving in since the first episode. It is going away from the Federation to a penal planet. So I guess it's nothing that we've not been told about already. Well, I think that's all we've got time for, but we've made a start on Blake 7, and I think that's quite exciting. I'm really glad we're doing this at long last. Mm-hmm. So we will return in the not-too-distant future, and we'll discuss Time Squad. That's the next one, isn't it, I think? Yes. We'll discuss Time Squad and the few episodes that follow that. But in the meantime, I will say a big thank you to Gareth.
Thank you very much.
And a big thank you and goodbye to Mark.
Thank you. Bye.
And we'll be back for more Blake 7 and more Spodcasting very soon. Goodbye now.